This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Well, I want to go to some news that you can possibly need first, quite possibly. You may have noticed that a lot of people are getting the flu. You may not have heard that some people are dying from the flu, and that there are places where hospitals are pretty much crammed to the point that heart-lung machines, ECMO machines, are all used up. Here is information from Recombinomics.com. Henry Nyman, who has been kind enough to give interviews on this program here on KBOO Portland. And on his website, Recombinomics.com, he wrote on January 5th, the flu outbreak is growing and so is the demand for vaccine, according to officials. Dallas County is now reporting 8 deaths due to the flu. That's Dallas County, Texas. And another 9 additional suspected flu deaths. The Beaumont Health Director, Beaumont, Texas, tells us 2 more people died at Christus St. Elizabeth from the virus, bringing the total to 8 deaths. They range in age from 24 to 73. And he says that this is describing a large number of PH1N1 deaths in Dallas County and one hospital in Beaumont. However, over 60 deaths have been reported in the state of Texas, and these reported cases only represent a fraction of the deaths, raising concerns that significant increases will be reported in upcoming weeks. Adult deaths from influenza are not reportable. Yeah. Isn't that strange? And that makes things kind of difficult. And right now, obviously I'm departing from this text. Right now, I can, and you can pull up topic influenza on the web, and you can probably see the sort of thing that's going on. I'm stumbling because I'm trying to do exactly that on my computer here, and it's balking. Darn bulky computers. Anyway, they don't make good radio. You need assistance to do that sort of thing, I guess. But this is happening around the nation, and this is happening in Oregon. Latest, as I reported last week, information was 80 hospitalizations and I think one, maybe two deaths in Oregon from influenza. This is pretty serious stuff. And this is H1N1 is hitting Oregon by and large. There's interesting information about H5 around the world, but right now H1N1 is the problem in the U.S. Returning to Henry Nyman's text, the recent deaths are also concentrated in young and middle-aged adults, many of whom were previously healthy. The number of reported cases in Texas is grossly underrepresented in part due to widespread use of rapid tests. More than 60% of confirmed flu cases in Texas are confirmed by rapid test, which have a low sensitivity for PH1N1, as indicated in advisories by Texas, the Centers for Disease Control, and California. Moreover, almost all the cases listed on the maps are delineated in media reports. Thus, while there are 17 cases cited in Dallas County, there's only one case cited in adjacent Fort Worth. Other large cities are also glaringly missing cases, while others such as Hidalgo County have reported 6 confirmed cases out of a total of 24. Thus, the cases referred to here are only a fraction of the fatal cases, and the large number of hospitalized cases indicate these numbers will increase significantly in the upcoming weeks. This is what I'm seeing, looking at these, Google alerts on the web. And have more information. This from the Centers for Disease Control. They write, according to this week's FluView report, flu activity in the United States continues to increase. 25 states are now reporting widespread levels of activity. Additional increases across the country are expected in the coming weeks. Anyone aged 6 months or older who has not gotten a flu vaccine yet this season should get one now. This is where I speak for myself again and talk about vaccines. Right now, you can get some good vaccines. Vaccination is an established method for creating immunity. And you know me, I'm going to throw in some caveats. I know that people remember that back in 09, I started saying, watch out for these vaccines, because, not because vaccination doesn't work or I'm anti-science or something. No, because they're produced commercially and therefore often produced first for profit and therefore irresponsibly. And at the time, there was talk and I believe actual use of squalene in the vaccines which were being rapidly produced. And the reason that substance was being put in is because there wasn't enough stuff to go around. And squalene is called an adjuvant, and you put it in a vaccine to inflame the immune system. It's kind of a dangerous way to do things. And the idea is you don't have enough dead virus in your vaccine because you had to dilute because you have so many people who need it. So you add in the squalene, and the idea is the squalene is going to inflame your immune system. It's going to make you sick, basically. And then your inflamed immune system, which is like up and in prize fighting stance, will say, hey, there's some H1N1 in here. And the idea is that it works. I don't know. Maybe it works. I mean, when I say I don't know, it's because I haven't researched that. But I do know that squalene can have some pretty serious side effects, and that's why I was saying that those vaccines could be dangerous. And when I say those vaccines could be dangerous, there's this echo, wom, 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 wom. You hear it? Wom, 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 wom. And the wom, wom is dogma that is in people's heads because, well, for a number of reasons. There was the talk of autism being caused by vaccines. I'm not going to address that at the moment. There are memories of, and certainly I can point to my own case of just the most irresponsible shenanigans by the pharmaceutical industry. However, bringing it back to the present, you can get a vaccine right now. They're not being overproduced. They do not have squalene, as far as I know, and it's helpful. So returning to the Centers for Disease Control report, for the week of December 22nd and 28th, the proportion of people seeing their health care provider for flu increased significantly and is above the national baseline for the fifth consecutive week. All 10 regions reported ILI activity at or above their region-specific baseline levels, or in other words, the flu is up. They also write 20 states experienced high activity. This is an increase up from 6 states that reported high activity last week. 8 states in New York City experienced moderate activity. 6 states experienced low activity. 16 states experienced minimal. The District of Columbia did not have sufficient data. There's a story there, but anyway. 25 states report widespread geographic influenza activity, an increase from 10 states in the previous week. 20 states reported regional activity, Puerto Rico, and 3 states reported local activity. I'm telling you this because this stuff, gestalting as best I can from what media information is available and what I observe personally as, frankly, as a bus driver. There is a really nasty flu going around. We do know that it has killed many people. So I want you to take that seriously. And if you start feeling really sick, well, start really taking care of yourself because you might save your life. And you're listening to Press Watch, weekly counter propaganda and left opinion program. I'm Teresa Mitchell, and I have some more information that I'd like to pass on to you. And I would like to invite your phone calls. Now, one thing I would like to talk about is the economy. And I have some numbers, some statistics, if I can ever get my computer to work, which will, I think, open your eyes so wide that it'll actually kind of hurt and you'll need a hot compress on them later. But first, I want to start with this Rolling Stone article by Jesse Meyerson that has caused so much consternation on Fox News, Faux News, and other right-wing billionaire-protecting sources. It's titled, 5 Economic Reforms Millennials Should Be Fighting For, Guaranteed Jobs, Universal Basic Incomes, Public Finance, and More. Hello, I am the anarcho-socialist, and I like this stuff. So I'm going to read it. It's a new year, but one thing hasn't changed. The economy still blows. 5 years after Wall Street crashed, America's banker gamblers have only gotten richer, while huge swaths of the country are still drowning in personal debt. Tens of millions of Americans remain unemployed, and the new jobs being created are largely low-wage, subcontracted, part-time grunt work. Now, just speaking for myself, ain't that the truth? You know it's true. I mean, I could go on, but I think that we Americans, we working Americans, we who have the first degree, you know, just the most basic degree of social awareness, know that people are really suffering. And the stats and the numbers, oh my God, but I'll get to those in a minute. Back to the article by Jesse Meyerson in Rolling Stone's, millennials have been especially hard hit by the downturn, which is probably why so many people in this generation regard capitalism with a level of suspicion that would have been unthinkable a decade ago. But that egalitarian impulse isn't often accompanied by concrete proposals about how to get out of this catastrophe. Here are a few things, Jesse Meyerson writes, we might want to start fighting for pronto if we want to grow old in a just, fair society rather than the economic hellhole our parents have handed us. And when I see economic hellhole, well, I think of all the people sleeping on cold sidewalks that I saw on my way to the studio. But anyway, he writes, one, guaranteed work for everybody. The easiest and most direct solution is for the government to guarantee that everyone who wants to contribute productively to society is able to earn a decent living in the public sector. There are millions of people who want to work, and there's tons of work that needs doing. It's a no-brainer, and this isn't as radical as it might sound. It's similar to what Federal Works Projects Administration made possible during the Roosevelt's New Deal. And Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. vocally supported a public sector job guarantee in the 1960s, a job guarantee that paid a living wage that would anchor prices, drive up conditions for workers at mega corporations like Walmart and McDonald's, and target employment for the poor and long-term unemployed, people to whom conventional stimulus money rarely trickles all the way down. The program would automatically expand during the private sector downturns and contract during private sector upswings, balancing out the business cycle and sending people from job to job rather than job to unemployment when times get tough. Some economists have proposed running a job guarantee through the nonprofit sector, which would make it even easier to suit the job to the worker. Imagine a world where people could contribute the skills that inspire them, teaching, tutoring, urban farming, cleaning up the environment, painting murals rather than telemarketing or whatever stupid task bosses need done to supplement their millions. Sounds nice, doesn't it? It does sound nice to me, and it certainly reflects well on what I've learned about how talented people can be. And I've learned that from volunteering at KBOO all these years. You just don't know what people can do until you let them loose and see what they can accomplish. And sometimes you can just be astonished. So I'm going to go down this list from the Rolling Stones article, maybe I should call it the article of Satan, the article that Fox News and Glenn Beck and all of these right-wing commentators hate so much. And certainly the Republican Party hates it and apparently fears it, because it's not often you can get the Republican Party commenting on an article in the media, but they certainly are doing that in the case of this one. It's that Rolling Stones article. And as I was saying, it starts off with guaranteed work for everybody. Number to call with your comments, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Second suggestion, Social Security for all. But let's think even bigger, he writes, because much as unemployment blows, so do jobs. What if people didn't have to work to survive? Either the jaw-droppingly simple idea of universal basic income, in which the government would just add a sum sufficient for subsistence to everyone's bank account every month. A proposal along these lines has been gaining traction in Switzerland, and it's starting to get a lot of attention here. We live in the age of 3D printers and self-replicating robots. Actual human workers are increasingly surplus to requirement. That's one major reason why we have such a big unemployment problem. A universal basic income would address this epidemic at the root and provide everyone, in the works of Duke professor Kathy Weeks, time to cultivate new needs for pleasures, activities, senses, passions, affects, and socialities that exceed the options of working and saving, producing, and accumulating. Put another way, a universal basic income combined with a job guarantee and other social programs could make participation in the labor force truly voluntary, thereby enabling people to get a life. You like that idea? I do. Number to call, 503-231-8187. And now what I wanted to add to this information is just how much money is available for that sort of thing. is available? Yeah, I said is available. And, well, let me give you this this article first. The Senate on Wednesday haggled over competing proposals to extend unemployment benefits. Remember this for the long-term jobless. I bet you do remember if you're hoping that your unemployment payments will be extended. With negotiators searching for a compromise that could extend the insurance program for a longer period than currently envisioned. And here's another gap while I try to figure out what the computer just did to me. Here we are. Republicans, who provided a key block of 6 votes to keep the legislation alive Tuesday, offered several proposals for for offsetting budget cuts that would match the more than $6.4 billion it would cost for a 3-month extension of the benefits program. Democrats continued to oppose the alternative budget cuts to justify such a short extension, but they opened the door to finding cuts if the extension was longer. The implication that $6.4 billion was difficult to raise or significant in terms of what is actually raised in the Senate brought howls and then peals of laughter on the Senate floor, where the monthly $75 billion quantitative easing giveaway is often a topic. As if, says Senator Durbin, gasping for breath, $395 billion for that worthless F-35, he continued, but he was unable to complete his sentence due to the general hilarity, which ended with two senators being carried out on stretchers, one with asthma and the other with a Charlie horse. Okay, I made that last part up. No one in the Senate as much as cracked a smile, in fact, as they pretended that a piddling $6 billion for unemployment insurance was a crisis that required careful remediation of existing expenditures. The press genuflected as usual, making no obvious comparisons or connections. But here's a mental exercise for you. You remember those mental exercises where your income is a sheet of paper and the billionaire's income is the Eiffel Tower? Well, let's stack some of those Eiffel Towers together and talk about where they're hiding. Eiffel Towers of wealth, if you will. Remember that one of the low figures for tax evasion accounts where the super rich and corporations send their money so it'll be hidden, so they don't have to pay their full taxes or any taxes, you know, in the Caymans, Lesser Antilles, Switzerland banks, etc., is $13 trillion. That's one of the low. $13,000 billion in American usage of the term trillion. Another way to say it is 13 million million. The population of the United States is around 300 million. Divide 300 into 13 million. Go ahead. Get your answer in millions of dollars for each man, woman, and child in the United States. The number is 43,333. $43,333.33 for every citizen in the U.S. if it were distributed evenly, which I'm not suggesting, actually. Oh, yeah, a good chunk of that. I would love to see that. But remember, we were just talking about the Rolling Stones article about having a minimum income. And the first thing some people are going to say is, where would the money come from? Are we going to soak the rich? What about freedom? Well, just keep that number in mind. $43,333,000,33. That's how high them Eiffel Towers are compared to your slip of paper. Or, of course, we could keep licking billionaire boots and watch the world go down the toilet. Your choice. Number to call 503-231-8187, and Joe is on the line.
I'm so glad that you're sharing this piece, Teresa. I am involved with the Old Mole Collective, and I just wanted to...
Yay, Old Mole, every Monday morning.
Yeah, every Monday morning, 9 to 10, I just wanted to say a couple things about this, but also let people know that Clayton Mortgage will be doing an interesting commentary on that piece and the very disturbing vitriol that has kind of erupted around it and what that says about the possibility.
Oh, yeah, you're not supposed to think that. You know, Occupy cracked the door open to thinking about that. That's the biggest thing that Occupy did. And now, well, horse is out of the barn. What are we going to do?
Yeah, but what's really interesting about these five reforms is that they aren't reforms in kind of the old capitulating with capital sense. They're what André Gorz, a French economist and critic of a lot of economic reason, called non-reformist reforms, where, you know, they they work within the system, but in a way that short circuits the system's rationale in a way that can be
right on. Yes, exactly. These aren't reforms that say, oh, please, may we have just a dime, sir. These are reforms that say, hey, this is our society. What are you doing with all that money? Where'd you get it? You got it from me.
Yeah, and I think what's important to bear when thinking about the kind of change that they can foster is that it's not all or nothing. It's going to be that some people make the most of it right away, and other people have to somehow kind of relearn how to be free, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Excellent. Excellent points. Thanks for calling in. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Let's go to that third suggestion in Rolling Stone. Ever notice how much the landlords blow? It's under the category take back the land. They don't really do anything to earn their money. They just claim ownership of buildings and charge people who actually work for a living the majority of our incomes for the period of staying in boxes that these owners often didn't build and rarely, if ever, improve. In a few years, my landlord, he writes, will probably sell my building to another landlord and make off with the appreciated value of the land she or he also claims to own, which won't even get taxed as long as she or he plows it right back into more real estate. Think about how stupid that is. The value of land has nothing to do with my idle remote landlord. It reflects the nearby parks, subways, and shops, which I have access to thanks to the community and the public. So why doesn't the community and the public derive the value and put it towards uses that benefit everyone? Because capitalism is why. The most mainstream way of flipping the script is simple land value tax. By targeting wealthy real estate owners and their free rides, we can fight inequality and poverty directly, make disastrous asset price bubbles impossible, and curb Wall Street's hideous bloat. There are cooler ideas out there, too. Municipalities themselves can become big-time landowners, and groups can even create large-scale community land trusts so that the land is held in common. In any case, we have to stop letting rich people pretend they privately own what nature provided everyone. I love that. And we're only three items down. But I'll go to the next caller. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Thomas is on the air.
Yeah, good morning, Teresa. It's great to hear about the Rolling Stone article. They've been doing some great journalism on these economic and banking issues for the last couple of years, and I'm glad to hear they're continuing it. Hey, I just wanted to mention that how maddening it is that, the whole entire broad social discussion of economic issues in this country for the last 20 years, it's just become incredibly, so artificially and ridiculously constrained, and it's throughout essentially all of the mainstream media. And I think, it's good that we need to pinch ourselves, remind ourselves that, this is really in-the-box thinking. This is the United States government has the authority constitutionally to mint its own money, and the United States has, we talk about all this stuff about the deficit and the debt. We need to remind ourselves, who's the government in debt to, and why is that so, and why is the U.S. Treasury in debt? It's ridiculous and it's ludicrous. The only thing we need to ask if they're about addressing issues of human need and what needs to happen in society is what materials do we have at our disposal and what human knowledge and how many, what sort of worker base do we have to draw upon? That's the only real thing. There's no such thing as a shortage of money at the national level.
Oh, absolutely not. You remember that that 43? Yeah. What you going to do with your 43 million?
Right. It's absolutely artificial. And the fact is that the banks create money through the instrument of debt. Anybody who doubts that's true needs to research it. Almost all the money, quote unquote, in our economy is created by the dynamic of debt lending. And there's no reason why the United States can't tax these huge pools of undeserved assets by these big banks. There's no reason why all the accounting sheets can't be changed and funds can't be immediately directed, because funds are intangible. They're just exchange tokens. We can do anything that's meaningful and useful in society that we want, and it's time that we quit even falling into this narrative of the ruling class and their phony baloney economics and phony baloney indicators, and focus on what's real and what needs to be done.
Right on, right on, right on. Thank you for calling in. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Let's go to the fourth item, make everything owned by everybody. Hoarders blow, he writes. Take, for example, the infamous 1%, whose ownership of capital stock of this country leads to such horrific inequality. Remember that $43 million that belongs to you I was talking about? $43 million. Yeah, no, I'm not making it up. That's called mathematics. $13 trillion. Oh, yeah. Capital stock refers to two things here. The buildings and equipment that workers use to produce goods and services, and the stocks and bonds that represent ownership over the former. The top 10% ownership of the means of production is represented by the fact that they control 80% of all financial assets. This detachment means that there's a way easier way to collectivize wealth ownership. Oh, I just love to say that, collectivize wealth ownership, than having to stage uprisings that seize the actual airplanes and warehouses and whatnot, although that's loads of fun, just buy up their stocks and bonds. When the government does that, it's called a sovereign wealth fund. Think of it like a big investment fund that buys up assets from the private sector and pays dividends to all permanent U.S. residents in the form of a universal basic income. Alaska already has a fund like this in place. They like it. Oh, yeah. They spend it. If it's good enough for a Levi Johnston, it's good enough for you. I'll go to the next caller. We're almost out of time. Gino, what's up?
I'm a person who believes in capitalism. I own a small business, and I believe your paycheck comes from capitalism, doesn't it?
No. No, a good paycheck is what is extracted from the value of the workers. So the more workers you have to extract from, the bigger your paycheck as a capitalist can be. And their paycheck can be as low as the desperation that is enforced by capitalism can make it. So the parasitism goes on and on and on. Although in a small business, that's not so exaggerated. Walmart, yes, exaggerated. And so that's where I direct my attention first, not against small business owners. So, you know, more power to you, and I hope that you succeed. And it's 9:28. My goodness, it's 9:29. That means it's time for more of the Incomparable Radio Zine on KBOO Portland. I hope that you will stay tuned.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the Worldbeat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin' Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to A Deeper Look here on KBOO. I'm your host, Linda Olson-Osterlund. Today is January 11th, 2013, 12 years to the day since the illegal prison camp at Guantanamo Bay was opened. Throughout the country, closed Guantanamo demonstrations and activities will be taking place this week, and for the first time in years, protesters are feeling a little encouraged by the U.S. government's actions. To talk about the changes affecting Guantanamo and the actions demanding its closure, I'm bringing you UK journalist, filmmaker, and author Andy Worthington. He's the author of The Guantanamo Files, really the definitive expert on prisoners who've been held at Guantanamo. He's in the United States today taking part in closed Guantanamo activities, so I interviewed him earlier this week. Welcome back to KBOO, Andy Worthington.
Thank you, Linda, and Happy New Year.
Yes, Happy New Year to you, too. You're coming to the United States again when we're freezing.
Yes, well, it was unfortunate that President Bush decided to open Guantanamo in January.
Yes.
Because, you know, this will be the fourth year that I've come over to engage in activities on and around the anniversary of the prison's opening.
Well, and I do believe that when I first spoke to you probably about 5 years ago, that we all thought that Guantanamo might be closed by now.
Yes.
And that has not happened. So let's talk about that. There have been some significant changes in December coming out of the administration, including more releases. Can you talk
about
that?
I mean, what we've actually had for many years now is it's virtually nothing happening when it comes to Guantanamo. And that was essentially because Congress imposed, pretty onerous restrictions on the president's ability to release prisoners. He had to jump through a lot of hoops. and certify that if prisoners were released, they weren't going to be able to engage in any activities against U.S. interests. But the president always retained a waiver in the legislation that would have enabled him to bypass Congress if he regarded it as being in the national security interest of the United States, which it clearly is, and he has said this. But, you know, in the political calculations that were made, it simply wasn't significant enough for the president to enrage Republicans by expending political capital on Guantanamo. So this went on, you know, for 3 years, essentially. Just five men were released from Guantanamo in 3 years. And then last year, the prisoners themselves really forced Guantanamo back onto the agenda.
And that's a really important point you're making there, Andy, I think that gets ignored in the mainstream press, which is that the hunger strike that had as many, I believe, according to the Miami Herald, as 102 participants at one time and still may have around 30, that is really what forced the administration to respond because the international outrage grew.
That's absolutely right, yes. And what a dreadful way for the president to confront the necessity to do something about it, you know, through these men, you know, genuinely endangering their lives through this prison-wide and very severe hunger strike. So, yeah, I mean, it was that provoked him. In May, he delivered a major speech in which